So it says punch by pressing punch. And I'm like, what? This is Up, Up, Down, Down, the show about the art and craft of video games. I'm Alan Pike. Joining us today is Nigel Brook, 15-year veteran of the games industry, having worked for Radical Entertainment, later Activision, is now co-founder of Steam Clock Software. Hi, Nigel.
Hello.
Also joining us today is Philippe Casgrain. Philippe is an iOS and Mac developer and runs the NS North Conference and podcast. In a previous life, he was a developer at Trans Gaming. Hi, Phil.
Hello.
Our topic today is porting games. That's both the economics, how it gets done, as well as the technical side. Phil's worked, like I said, at Trans Gaming, working on the technology used to port games to the Mac. So there's quite a few sort of interesting technical challenges in that process of taking a game, whether it was intended to be ported or not when it was originally developed, and bringing it to a new platform. So do you want to start by telling us a little bit, Phil, about what it was that you did at Transgaming?
Right. So as you mentioned, it's about porting games. So if I just rattle off a quick list of stuff that I've worked on, you know, like Guild Wars, Settlers 7, Dragon Age 1 and 2, the Grand Theft Auto Trilogy, Toy Story 3, Cars 2, FIFA 2012, Sims, EVE Online, Lego Universe, which no longer exists, Rayman 4, Settlers, all of these games I've worked on, but
I've heard of those games.
Yes, exactly. But I worked 3 years at Transgaming, so obviously I didn't work on all of these games all the time. So what I was doing there was I was part of the core team. There were two basic teams at Transgaming to do the porting. One was core, which was one was graphics, which was basically the DirectX to OpenGL translation layer, which means that because all the Windows games are. Sorry, not all, but the vast majority of Windows games are actually built on DirectX. A few are built on OpenGL. So they make DirectX calls and expect things to happen on a video card. And the Transgaming engine just intercepts these calls and renders them into OpenGL so that they run natively on the GPU and are pretty darn fast. So that was the graphics team, and the core team, which I was on, was everything but the graphics. So networking, memory, disk access, any kind of windowing API, all of these things, a mouse, keyboard, you name it, that was the core team.
So is that building out the emulation layer that lets the game continue to assume it's running on Windows, but it's actually running on a Mac, basically?
Yes, and I have to correct you, it's not an emulation, it's a virtualization.
Okay.
Yes. So the difference is that Wine, what it does, or which is the underlying technology underneath the porting engine, what it does is it implements the Windows API. So if you call, say, new window on Windows, you expect the function to be at a certain address and you expect it to return certain values. That's what Wine does, right? Or get cursor or things like that. All the Windows API, Win32 APIs. So that's what the virtualization layer does, and it just translates them sometimes to the Mac. Like if you want get cursor, you need to know where the mouse is, right? So you need to call the Mac cursor and get that information back to the Windows through and in the right order and with the right parameters and with the right error handling and all of that. So that's what it does for all the functions in the Windows API.
Which is a fairly large number of obscure, bizarre functions.
Yes.
And it's not just like, oh, okay, here are the ones that we need. But you need to also implement the bizarre edge cases and even bugs in some cases that the games might depend on, right?
Exactly. So so the ones that we need, we actually know because you can look at what it's linking against and get a list of all the functions that are external to the game that it wants, like in the Win32 DLL and things like that. You can get a list of all of those. So sometimes when you're evaluating a game, it's like, could we port this to the Mac? Well, then to Linux, you look at it. Oh, it's calling this function that we don't have in our library of ported functions because we know we have a complete list and we can just sort and look at what's supported or not. And then we can evaluate how much time it's going to cost us to create this function and then move on, you know? So that's part of the business. But the edge cases are very, very interesting because we like to call it bug for bug compatibility because there's bugs in the Windows API. There's bugs in every API, right? But you would think like if I call an API that expects an unsigned int and I call it with -1, well, you know, something bad would happen. Like it would either crash or just do nothing or something like that. Well, it turns out that some of these APIs in Windows, they do something, and they do something that's interesting or unexpected or jump to a special place in memory. And a lot of games actually depend on that behavior for multiple reasons, the chief one being DRM. Yes. So you have to implement the bugs in order for the DRM system, which also thinks it's running on Windows, to run properly.
My guess would be that that's not an exact science, that given DRM is intentionally trying to be obtuse or unusual. Yes. And hard to understand.
Yes. 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 There were some very, very smart people on that team, and then there was me. So
that's a good place to be, right?
Yes. Learn from the best.
So with the stack that you have there, as I understand it, Wine is an open source project that's been around for a long time that I believe started as a way to try and get Windows apps to run on Linux.
Correct.
And then Sedega is a fork of Wine that was originated by Transgaming in order to get... is it specific? Was it a game-specific port, or was it a Mac-specific port?
It was a game-specific port, because this was in the early 2000s. So right. The Mac on Intel didn't exist, right? So the idea of Sedega was to take the Wine engine and then make a special fork of it that would be tuned for games. Because Wine by itself, and you can get Wine today, right? Wine exists as a project today. It's alive and well. It's under the GPL license. But way back when, it was under LGPL, which means that you can, if you provide the Wine stuff as a separate DLL, you don't have to ship the source code with it, right? That's my basic understanding of the LGPL. So if you're GPL, not only do you have to do that, but you also have to ship the source code so that you can build the libraries that you're linking against. That's one of the reasons why there's no, up until now, there's no GPL stuff inside of the App Store, because there's only one binary. Like, there's no dynamic linking, right? That's what is preventing a lot of stuff that's GPL. But I'm getting ahead of myself. What you want is you want to make a specialized version of Wine that is specially tuned for games. If you know graphics really well and you know DirectX and OpenGL really well, you can make a special version of Wine that will run really, really well on Linux systems. And I'm talking, you know, if the game runs on Windows at 60 FPS and the game runs on Linux at 50 FPS, well, that's pretty darn good, you know. So you basically won't see the difference. And you're running in a virtualization environment. So if you don't have to ship the source code with it, it's a huge boon from a you know, being a company that can license this technology or that can say, I will do it for you for a fee or something like that. So Transgaming was in the beginning doing ports for Linux, and there's not a whole lot of market to selling games on Linux. So what they would sell would be the engine. So you would have a subscription service, and then you would subscribe to the subscription engine, and the engine would get revved on a regular basis. And then you would buy your Windows game, either online or in a CD. Remember those? You know, get in store. There's a bargain bin stuff. You could just get the CD and put it into your Linux PC and run it using the Wine engine, or the Sedega engine, sorry. And voila, your Windows game would run directly on your Linux system.
So I got to say, back when I was crazy enough to have a Linux box in the heady days of university, I couldn't even get the Wi-Fi to work, let alone trying to get some ported game.
Yes.
I did actually have some success getting stuff to run under Wine when I had my brief flirtation with Linux as my main operating system, but I never managed any games running.
Right.
There was a couple of, like, essential applications sort of thing. Like, at that point, I needed, like, a custom application to do online banking. Like, I couldn't do online banking through my bank through a website yet. And so I managed to get that app, and there was, like, one or two others that's, like, there's no substitute. I can't just switch to some different word processor that's mostly word compatible and it's good enough. You know, there's those couple of programs that you can't get away from, but it's certainly... but it's definitely gotten a lot better since those days. Like, I use just I think the stock build of wine basically all the time for a lot of like level editing tools and stuff like that. My kids have gone through these various phases of wanting to mod particular games. You know, they'll get like an old game on an emulator and be like, oh, can we add some stuff to this or change some stuff around? So I'll go and look around and be like, yeah, there's a level editor for Super Mario 64 DS, but it's just a Windows executable. And pretty much every time that that's happened and I've been like, all right, I'll fire it under Wine and see what happens, it's just worked. Like, no issues, nothing like that.
Oh, yeah,
like,
you're absolutely right. Wine is fantastic for that. The cool thing is that they maintain a list of all the apps that are compatible, and they're really good about anything that's windowed, like a multiple window interface. But if it's anything that's got graphics, well, up until recently, because I admit I haven't kept up with the recent stuff, but up until recently, their translation from DirectX to OpenGL was fairly basic and not super performant. So old games would be okay because you have enough hardware to throw at them, but newer games would be no way unplayable, right?
Yeah, with all of those graphics APIs and modern hardware, if your software is not keeping up with what the graphics card can actually do, then any imitations are either going to look bad or be slow or both.
Right, and the transgaming fork of Wine foregoed all these Windowsism. Like you wouldn't be able to run like Word using the Cider engine or the Cydiga engine, right? It just doesn't work that way. That's not complete for that, but it would run games really good, and games have their own UI, right? So they don't really care about your windowing system or your menu system or whatever, whereas applications like Nigel, you were saying, those care really a lot about how they look on screen and how they call the system APIs.
There's a long, glorious history of the stub in just the stuff you need. Like, there's the famous... Yes. Story of how the original version of Quake got ported to OpenGL on the 3DFX cards, right? Where Carmack basically did the port against like a workstation quality GL driver and then gave the 3DFX engineers a list of like, okay, here's all of the function entry points that I'm actually calling. And they gave them back a DLL that basically just implemented those entry points rather than implementing the whole OpenGL spec. And then that, so, you know, Quake was all written in something that just looked like pure OpenGL and it ran on 3DFX cards, but 3DFX cards didn't actually implement OpenGL properly. So
there was cards that were shipping that had exactly the subset of OpenGL that John Carmack needed, but not a single function more.
That's basically.
That's awesome. It's nice when if you're porting a game that's important enough that the hardware makers will bake your game right into the card.
You remember WebSafe Colors from the early 90s?
Yes.
You know, that's basically what it is, right?
But for OpenGL.
Yes.
So Cydiga was the Linux sort of port for doing games on Linux of Wine. And then Cider is the sort of Mac evolution of that.
Right. So in 2006, Apple shipped Intel Macs, right? So that was a revolution. You could actually run the engine that powers Cydiga on a Mac. So the business insight there was to say, well, instead of shipping the engine as a service and having this this little UI that allows you to select games and read CDs and stuff, why don't we just make a .app package that has the whole engine inside and then that has the whole game inside? And when you double-click it, we'll just do the right thing and then launch, you know, essentially launch a process that runs Wine and does the correct loading of the Windows DLLs and correct loading of the game, and then the game thinks it's running on Windows. So if you take any of these games that I listed in the beginning and you look at them on a Mac and it's just a .app package, but if you right-click and show package contents and you go to the resources folder, there's a folder called C Drive, which contains a folder called Windows and System 32.
I've seen this.
And,
yeah.
And, you know, whatever the game name was. So basically, we would just install the game from the CD into a folder to which it would be happy, and then we just copy this folder over and... You know, change a couple of names here and there to launch the right thing, and presto, instant Mac game.
So at that time in 2006, I had been a Mac user from about 2001 on, and I loved games, but it was entirely on the console because the only games that you could get from the Mac at that point were Maxis, so like the SimCity games, Blizzard, so that was like StarCraft and Diablo, I guess. And I believe that's because they were both using OpenGL for their games.
I'm not sure if they're using OpenGL. The rumor that I heard is that Blizzard does all their porting in house, and what they do is they write to their own 3D API that outputs DirectX on one side or OpenGL on the other. Or it could be that they just write to DirectX and they have their own DirectX to OpenGL translation layer.
That's certainly much more standard for companies that are just doing multi-platform. Like at Radical, that's exactly what we did. We had various hardware abstraction layers that we'd written internally. So we'd have a 2 million line of code game, but it would be written against a dozen or so hardware abstraction APIs for like sound, file system, graphics. And those APIs would total, maybe 150,000 lines of code, something like that. And that was what you needed to port to a new platform anytime you switch platforms, was just that core.
Yeah, exactly.
And that was the team you were on, right, Nigel? The core engine team?
Yeah, there was about three different groups sort of that worked on that eventually got folded together in the same team, but a lot of the APIs were still separate. So we had a graphics team, and we had the sound team, and we had like an everything else team basically that sort of handled, the main game loop startup kind of stuff, like the message pump and stuff like that. And then also any abstraction that didn't really fit into graphics or sound. So file system, networking,
memory,
memory allocation, like all of that stuff was input. Basically like one. Yeah. Input. That was the group that I was in, and the hardware, it wasn't just the hardware abstraction layers. Like we had both a hardware abstraction layer, and then we had like a higher level API. We tried to keep the hardware abstraction as small as we possibly could because
only 150,000 lines of code.
Yeah. Well, I mean, in a 2 million plus line of code game,
I know
that is pretty small. And even some of that code was actually semi shared. Like we had, one iteration of our graphics technology for the Xbox and the PC shared like 70 or 80% of the DirectX code between the two versions, and then had some custom code. And then eventually they totally branched when we got sort of new interfaces on the Xbox 360 that it wasn't worth trying to share stuff anymore.
A drag on performance, though, to have these abstraction layers. I guess maybe like you could compile down or optimize out some of it, but when you're working at one layer and then that's dispatching down to the layer below and that's dispatching down to the layer below, when you're trying to do really primitive graphics stuff, that sounds like that would be a drag on.
It can be. Like there's certainly some overhead involved in that approach versus having the raw graphics code everywhere. There's things that you can do to cut it down. One thing that we did is by having also control over this layer above, we could make sure that we could sort of punch holes when there was specific stuff that was a performance problem. We can say, all right, we're gonna have the hardware abstraction layer, but we're also gonna have a couple of like if defs in the quote high level close quote graphics code that special cases just a little bit to deal with some performance problem where it's not worth passing through the interface. And we try and keep things as batched up as possible. And there's some cases where you can almost do better. It's the same sort of thing as any optimization problem. The more information you have, the better optimization you can do. So when, if you give people the primitive shader API of just like, here's a bunch of like shader variables and just call these functions whenever you want to set them. That can actually end up being worse than saying, all right, here's an interface where you build a structure that defines all of your shader parameters. And then we can kind of poke through that, pre-compile, figure stuff out in advance you're going to end up with something that, yeah, theoretically someone could be more efficient writing against the raw API, but in practice, people aren't going to put the effort into it for every little rendering thing that they do. So it'll end up being faster overall to have the abstraction layer there.
I don't know much about graphics, but I do remember that one of the things that we were doing was to ask the game supplier to give us pre-compiled shaders, not just the the source code, so that way we could store the pre-compiled shaders and make everything faster as opposed to having to interpret them at runtime. And the other thing is we had hardware like a Mac Pro, right, with an 8800 GT card that would triple boot Windows, Linux, and Mac, and we could do perf tests between the three using the exact same hardware. So that was very enlightening because, as I said, you run the game on Windows and it runs at 60 FPS or higher on that hardware, and then you run it on Linux and it runs at like 50 FPS or higher. Then you run it on Mac and you drop down to 30 FPS, which is still acceptable, but kind of like, what the hell happened? It's not, it doesn't sound like, between Linux and Mac, there shouldn't be that much of a discrepancy because A, it's the same hardware, B, it's basically the same code. There were a few Mac-isms inside of a CIDR, but most of it was like, no, it's just a regular, Wine code that's just compiled for 8086. And one of the things we found, and I don't know how many things I'm breaching, but whatever, is that the OpenGL buffer on Mac is actually triple buffered. So there was an extra buffer that was getting written to by the OS that we had no control over, and that would delay things significantly on every, frame refresh. So it was like, oh crap, we can't do anything about that. So you might want to make your thing faster, but then again, you're blocked by the hardware and like, oh.
The Mac OpenGL drivers have historically been pretty terrible from a performance standpoint. Like they're good stability and quality wise compared to the other platforms, because Apple kind of keeps a tight rein on everything, whereas on Linux it's just a bunch of like teenagers in their parents' basement writing all the code, so who the hell knows what quality it's going to be. And then on Windows there's so much of it's on the actual driver writers, which like the actual video card manufacturers. So whereas, Apple, they keep a tight leash on things, but they haven't focused on performance historically. Like, because the Mac isn't a gaming platform, the games aren't good, because the games aren't good, the Mac doesn't become, and there's kind of this vicious cycle of...
Until they decide that games on a Mac are important, and then Epic shows on stage at WWDC or whatever. So it's like, and also you guys might remember 10.6.7, the update that Valve software, that makers of bunch of other games we all know about, like Portal and stuff, saying, and Valve came out and say, hey guys, don't install 10.6.7 because it's got Bork drivers. And then Apple quickly issued a 10.6.8 that had the correct drivers. So it's like, yeah. So sometimes speaking out publicly against these things, which, people always say, file a radar, don't say anything. But, Valve actually spoke up and got things fixed. That was kind of cool to watch.
Yeah, I believe after that, they brought Valve in and they have a bit more of a relationship with them. It doesn't seem like a great relationship, but they at least talk to each other now, which is an improvement.
Right. And then there's a bunch of things I can't probably tell you, but there's definitely the video card companies and companies that abuse video cards, like game makers, have lots of relationship with Apple at different levels. So it's like it's happening behind the scenes a lot, whether it's getting any traction or getting any visible results is completely another thing, but we do have later OpenGL now on the Mac, so that's kind of good.
Yeah, I think it's the new versions are finally like up to OpenGL 4 level, like the latest.
Exactly.
The latest ones. I think they're like 4.0 and the latest standard is 4.3 or something like that, but at least it's got the modern techniques, like you can use the frame buffer objects and you can, like, all the things that you just couldn't do even 3 or 4 years ago, at least,
possible now. If I remember correctly, you can also, basically OpenGL 4.0 roughly matches with DirectX 11 in terms of features that it can do, and then DirectX 12 comes out, and that's OpenGL 4.3, which is not supported-ish. But I may be speaking out of my ass here.
That sounds right to me. If those numbers aren't exactly correct, then it's something pretty close to that.
Something like that.
But regardless of whether or not, like what ratio that is of working together with Apple or just increased demand or whatever, the number of games that are being released on Mac now, like cross-platform, I mean, there was always some random Mac-only games like Escape Velocity, which was my favorite Mac-only game back in the day. But now if you look, and I just counted the top sellers on Steam right now, which is sort of screwed up because there's big sales going on today, but... six out of the top 16 games run on Mac, which is a pretty huge percentage compared to where we were.
Absolutely.
You know, not even just 2006, but maybe even like Steam for Mac came out, what, like four, maybe 3 or 4 years ago?
Something like that. Yeah, sounds about right. And that was a huge boon. But there's also a lot of games on the Mac App Store. A bunch of the games that I just rattled off, they're also Mac App Store, right? So that's been a huge outlet for games. So
yeah, if you look, I just fired up the App Store app here, and if you look at the top paid apps right now, you've got like SimCity 4, Roller Coaster Tycoon 3, Civilization 5, Star Wars Knights of the Old Republic, like stuff that's, you know, a little old, but you've heard of it, and it's not, it's not like ancient. Yep. Port shovelware. Oh, yeah. It's like, okay, yeah, it took an extra year for this stuff to get on the Mac, but it's here kind of thing.
Yeah, yeah. The economics of that are interesting too, because it's been my experience that games are a lot like movies in the sense that they make a lot of money in their opening week, and after that, it's kind of the long, long tail. So having a Mac port a year later is like, well, I played that a year ago, so why would I?
Yeah.
Yeah, and the economics and the way that stuff gets planned out, often you'll find studios, every once in a while there's somewhere like Blizzard that their games are so successful that they can always commit, and they have enough of a...
Or Valve,
right. They can always commit and they say, anytime we do a new game, it's going to be on Mac, because even if we only get 10% or even 2% more sales, then it makes sense to do it. But for a lot of the sort of medium, like AAA games, but they're not necessarily huge, everyone's been waiting for it for 5 years type games, the people will ask, like, oh, is there going to be a Mac version? And they'll say, well, you know, we don't have anything to announce on that.
Right. And that's kind of where Transgaming came in and said, well, you know that technology, because, you know, if you want to port something, like do a source code port, like we're going to give you the source code and you're going to make a game that runs on Mac, right? So that economically is like, or even in development time, it's going to take 6 people 9 to 18 months. There's like, that's the good rule of thumb I've seen when you're porting something, like you've got a known base and you want to move it to another platform. It's like, it's very generic, but it is, you can't rush that process very, very fast, even if you pour down a lot of money on it, and then the economics don't make sense. And if you put more people to try to make it faster, well, we know what happens to software. So there's like, it takes a team of talented people that's relatively small, but it's going to take them time, right? So Transgaming came in with a solution that says, hey, keep on working on your Windows game. We'll just make it run on Mac by magic. You give us your binaries and we'll put them in directly from your build system, whatever, and we'll make them run, and then we'll make a Mac version, and then we can QA it if you want, or you can QA it if you want as well, and then you can sim ship, like ship the thing on day one that's got a CD that's got, or DVD that's got both Mac and Windows version. So that's pretty awesome, because you get all the benefits of week one, right? So that's where Transgaming came in. There, I was not aware, maybe there are others, but I was not aware of any other companies that did this, like said, all right, we don't really care about your source code. We'll only ask it about it if we see you're doing something that we don't understand. But we really care about your binaries, and we just want to run them on Mac. So that, and we can simship, because it's going to take it's going to take a few weeks for us. So give us a few weeks prior when you're freezing your stuff anyway, and then we'll, do this for you.
Yeah, then it's definitely a good trade-off when you're thinking, okay, well, we can't justify a source port, because like based on that sort of math, if it's like 6 people and 18 months and the extra sort of support people you would need on that stuff, it's going to be at least $1 million, but maybe like up to $2 or $4 million to do that. And if you make like $10 per copy, that means you need to definitely sell hundreds of thousands of copies to not lose money. But really, it's like not like 100,000 isn't going to be enough. You might need to sell 500,000 copies. And when it's a game that's, a AAA game that it's not proven yet, like a new IP or something like that, you could that could easily just mean that you lose $2 million than you did. Like,
or what about a game that's tied to a year? Like, I don't know, FIFA, you know, FIFA 2014. Well,
sure.
You want the players of 2014 in 2014. You don't want them in 2013 or 2015, right? So there's that's very important for the games.
Some of that of how complicated it is to port also depends on what your general strategy for game development is. You know, you can do it way cheaper than that if you have a good hardware abstraction layer in place already. You know, in the case of like at Radical, we did a couple of PC versions of our games that cost us, I don't know, like maybe 2 or 3 programmer months worth of effort, because we just always had the game running on the PC anyways, because it was useful for development. So the amount of additional effort involved in shipping the PC game was basically only, you know, like a little bit of work on testing on different video cards and, you know, a little bit of work on like a control scheme that's competent with mouse and keyboard and, you know, send it out the door. And we never did a port like that to a new PC platform. Like, we'd never done a Linux or a Mac version, but we could definitely have done one of those if we wanted to in way less time than like 6 people, 12 months or something like that.
Right. But
like,
that's because you put all the money up front in the abstraction layer.
And we already have to pay for the abstraction layer to do Xbox, PS3, PC, and we need all of those platforms. So, but for Macs, it's still really not worth it because the market's getting so long tail at that point. You know, we'd have a game that would sell like 2 or 3 million units on the consoles and sell like maybe 100,000-200,000 on the PC. And you look at, you know, you like keep that trend line going towards Mac. And it's like, yeah, if we did a Mac port of this, like maybe we'd sell 50,000 copies if we were really lucky.
And at that point, it's like, and you sell 5 copies.
Yeah. At that point, it's like, there's no way this makes economic sense, right?
Right.
It's like the people who eventually gets to the point where it's like the people who are complaining that your site doesn't work in Opera. And can you be bothered to download Opera just to see why? But even though you had that abstraction layer and it was running on the PC, didn't you at one point have a game where there was a problem on the PC that you had a fix for?
Yeah, for Prototype. And this is the thing that'll get me sued if Bobby Kotick is listening to our show. Yeah, for Prototype, we shipped a PC version because Activision made us, basically. We didn't want to. We were like, no, don't do it. Like, it's not gonna sell any copies. It's just gonna get pirated a lot. Like, it's a console game. It's not, you know, it's not a game.
And the whole control scheme is really tuned to console.
Yeah, the control scheme's completely tuned for like consoles and game pads, and like you can play it with the mouse and keyboard, but it's not great. And don't ship it. But we were contractually obligated to ship it, and they wouldn't listen to us, and they shipped it anyways, and it sold quite poorly. I don't know the exact numbers, and you know, probably would get sued if I told them if I did, but I don't think it was much more than like very low 6 figures. Like, it wouldn't even surprise me if it was like tens of thousands of copies, but at most it was like 100,000 or 200,000 copies. And this was on a game that, like I said, sold like 2 or 3 or 4 million units on all the consoles, something like that. And there were various bugs in it, and you know, we didn't support some video resolutions properly because it was, you know, console game. Like, we didn't bolted in the like video resolution selection code. Like, one guy did it in like a weekend, 2 weeks before we shipped or something like that. And so we had a patch all ready to go, and Activision was like, we're not gonna bother shipping this. Like, it'll cost us more to QA it than it's worth given how many copies we've sold. And so we didn't, like, even though we had it all ready to go, we couldn't ship it, which was kind of a bummer.
And that's when you start thinking, like, do I really want to be working for one of these giants?
Yeah, I mean, I've often said that, you know, even though it's seems like such a minor thing, that was, you know, that was one of the things where I realized that, like, my tastes as a developer and Activision's tastes were not well aligned. Like, you know, I was definitely in the camp initially of like, we shouldn't have shipped this PC version to begin with, but once we have, like, I wanted to fix it and say, like, let's fix our couple of bugs and let's, like, give people a better video selection screen. And Activision was just like, no, there's no percentage in doing that. It's not going to make us enough money to fix the game. So leave it broken.
Yeah. And that's often a problem for ports in general. Like, I've played, you know, as somebody who has a Mac and spent many years being optimistic when a game would come out, and I'd be like, oh, why don't I just play it on the Mac that I have right here? Without reading the reviews or doing proper research beforehand, often it would be like, yeah, this game shipped with a horrible bug that, you know, when you're 2/3 of the way through, it deletes your save file, and supposedly there's a patch coming, but...
But you don't know if it's coming. I've seen the flip side of this for people who are tinkerers. They would buy, like... a cheap version of a Mac port that Transgaming had done with the Cider engine, and then they would extract the Cider engine because that was a valuable part, and would drop other games into it, so that they could download games, they could, you know, get them at the bargain bin on the CD because they were like $5 and they were like 3 years old, and it would probably run with the engine. There was a whole community of people who were doing this, saying which engine, because all the engines are versioned, and which engine works with which game, and then you could just, you know, basically run Mac game, Windows game on Mac using the just, you know, stealing the engine from the .app package, which I thought was a very interesting hack.
So it's like a clandestine version of Wine then.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm going to do a sponsor, and then I want to talk a bit about the control schemes and the differences that you want to be in between the different versions, and whether or not that actually happens when games get ported. So this episode is brought to you by Steam Clock Software. Steam Clock makes wonderful apps for iOS, Android, and the web. If you're a Fortune 500, a startup, or somewhere in between, and you're looking to work with a team who sweats every pixel, you can learn more at www.steamclock.com. So, control schemes and the other vagaries of the platforms. So we know that, especially nowadays, the different platforms, whether it's PC or console, and especially in between the console platforms, they're pretty much the same. Like, there's not a lot of fundamental differences in between a Xbox 360 and or a Xbox One and a PS4. But one thing that really sticks out when you have a port that's kind of done without the full care and attention to put into it is control schemes. And I was always sort of aware of this, but it's become much worse now in the modern days of games being developed really with consoles in mind, like you're saying about Prototype. And this bit me really badly when I wanted to play Assassin's Creed 2. Everyone's like, oh, you should play Assassin's Creed. And I was kind of behind the curve. And so by the time I decided to try and play the game, I saw that it was available on Mac. And it was on sale, too, or something like that. I think I got it on Steam at the time, or maybe it was the Mac App Store. But anyway, downloaded Assassin's Creed 2. I load it up, and the tutorial is just a series of it saying, like, you know, it puts you in some little hand-to-hand combat or something like that. And it's like, punch by pressing. And then in the space where on the, you know, on the PlayStation, it would say square icon, like the icon of the button on your controller. Instead, it says just the word punch formatted in really, really small letters so that they can fit where the graphic would be. So it says punch by pressing punch. And I'm like, what? And then I start kind of like keyboard mashing a little bit, and the guy's like beating me up. And eventually I kind of figured out what punch was. It was like, let's say it's space bar. And then it's like, okay, now like tackle by pressing tackle. And I'm like, what the hell? And then I press Esc and I go into the keyboard controls and I figure out where tackle was. But there's no, like, the entire game as it goes through the tutorial and then through the first level, it's often saying, like, have little notices, like hovering over someone's head is maybe the punch, the icon that just says punch, but that's like actually how you can talk to him, which in the context of a PlayStation game makes total sense. It would say X over his head. If you press X, you talk to that guy. But instead it says punch, which I still can never remember which is what character, which keyboard button, or actually sometimes it might be his left mouse click. And in one case, actually one of the buttons wasn't mapped properly by default, so it was impossible to do the thing it was telling him to do. And so I was like dying on the tutorial missions, and yeah, I tried to get my $19.99 back, but it was unsuccessful. Steam wouldn't refund me.
The interesting thing that I have in here is some games have, like, Windows mice sometimes have three buttons, right? I mean, Mac mice only have one or zero buttons, basically, yeah. But like three buttons. I have a middle button. And I remember something, I think it was Settlers Online, that you used the middle button to drop something. Like you would click something and as a resource and you want to drop it somewhere, you use the middle button. That was the tutorial. So like on the Mac, there's like no middle button. And we're like, okay, so what do we do? Do we map like you press the two buttons? And that used to work when... But it didn't, because the Magic Mouse got updated or something and you couldn't press two buttons at once. And then it's like there were a bunch of little things that were impossible. So we, you know, there's a little back and forth. There's a little questionnaire where you tell the developer, hey, if you want a Mac port of this, you might want to remove the middle mouse graphic in your thing because it's not going to work on Mac. And now they go, oh, yeah, well, we need to figure out another control scheme for this. So that was the interesting thing. And the other one was the Xbox controller is actually a USB controller, and it's got a USB plug and everything. And you can plug it into your Mac, and it doesn't do anything by default. But if you download a piece of freeware that's an Xbox driver, you can basically use the Xbox controller on your Mac as an actually pretty decent gamepad for running a lot of games. So we wrote a lot of support for the Xbox gamepad because, frankly, the Mac gamepads in general sucked. I mean, in terms of response time, in terms of not the delay, but the difference between off and on, like in a joystick that's got proportion, you know, there was not a whole lot of range and things like that, it was of highly varying quality, and they all really suck. Whereas the Xbox one is actually very, very decent gamepad. And so the little known trick was, like, if you wanted to play games on a Mac, was to get an Xbox 360 controller.
I actually, everyone said that when I was struggling with Assassin's Creed 2, and fortunately I didn't, and still don't at this time, own an Xbox, but I did have a PlayStation 3, and there was another piece of freeware you could get to plug in a PlayStation 3 controller, and it worked okay, and so I ended up getting the PlayStation 3 controller hooked up to Assassin's Creed 2, but it was almost even worse then, because then it was like, yeah, I said, you know, quick time events where, like, you know, a bear is about to eat you, and it's like circle, or it should say, like, circle, 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 but instead it says, like, light kick, light kick, light kick, and I'm like, ah.
Yeah, that's pretty good.
I always feel like I've installed that Xbox 360 controller driver on like every Mac I've owned, and it is actually remarkably good, but it always feels like you're just like going to some random GeoCities page to download, yes, like the official Xbox controller driver. Like, it's not like it's the only one there is and everyone uses it and it's good quality, but it is just like some random guy. Like, it's, yeah, not, it's nothing to do with Apple or Microsoft or anything. It's ridiculous.
Exactly. Yeah. But you get to feel elite, right? When you do this, like, I'm installing a driver. Ooh, I'm on a Mac.
And also, it's like nothing's hit yet. Things could get better in this regards. Like, with Mavericks, they introduced official game controller APIs, but yeah, nothing seems to support them yet. Like, there's like one standalone gamepad on the Apple's, like, on, you know, Apple's online store that'll work with, and I don't think they even say it'll work with the Mac, but I believe all that stuff is sort of the same interfaces, so it should, and it's like $80 for a third-party gamepad, and it's just it's ridiculous.
Probably a pretty good quality, much better quality than the Mad Cat's $30 thing that never works. But then again, you pay $30 and get something that never works versus paying $80 and getting something that works all the time. But then it's about playing games, so
yeah. With the with the control schemes, I think it's interesting that there's probably four almost disjoint control schemes that you have to consider in games these days. Like, you have to consider the gamepad, you have to consider mouse and keyboard, you have to consider trackpad and keyboard, I think, actually separately, because there's certain things that, like, first-person shooters are great with mouse and keyboard, but are not great with trackpad and keyboard compared to...
Oh, yeah, don't get me started on natural scrolling. When that got introduced and everybody was scrolling the other way.
Like, and then, you know, now you've got touch control in there as well, yeah, right? So you've got, you know, any game that's going to be very wide multi-platform needs to think about, you know, do I have an approach to all of those control schemes? And unfortunately, what a lot of people do is they do like the on-screen gamepad controls for touch, or they do the, you know, they do the like okay, we're just going to map like four keys to one of the sticks basically, and the mouse to the other stick for third person action games. And it's, you know, it's an incredible pain in the butt, you know, that, and that's where things like the, you know, the automated porting technology kind of start breaking down, is if you have to deal with multiple control schemes, it's really hard to do that without just thinking about it at the design level and how are we going to approach this. You know, you can't take a game that's written for a gamepad and say, all right, well, we're going to do a version of this that's going to work on a mouse and keyboard automatically. You got to think about how are we going to approach this. And for touch, it's even worse.
Games, like if you look at Katamari Damacy, if either of you played that, it's a dual analog stick game. And if you don't have the dual analog sticks, like you lose the game. Like you just, a version of it with mouse and keyboard, you could build it, but people would probably almost certainly be like, yeah, I mean, I don't know, it's kind of awkward. You know,
and I seem to remember there were some online games like I think it's Battlefield 2042, or it might be others, where you would play online with other people, and they would actually segregate servers: people who play with mouse and keyboard on one server, and people who play with gamepad on the other server, because the people who play with mouse and keyboard would just basically slaughter people with the gamepad because their responses are just not the same, right? So mouse and keyboard, you can do headshots easier with your mouse than you can with the gamepad, like aiming and stuff. So they would segregate them for that very reason.
In World of Warcraft, one of the things you needed to be able to do in certain areas in order to survive would be to run and then leap and then rotate 180 degrees in the air and then shoot the person that's behind you and then rotate back again before you land. And this is just like this sort of kiting thing where like you have somebody, a monster chasing you, and you're jumping, shooting them behind you, jumping, shooting behind you as you're running. And with a mouse and keyboard, it's when the first person someone explained that to me, I was like, is that even possible? And then I got pretty good at it. But on a console, it would be impossible to do. Like, there's just no way you could have a joystick-based control scheme that would let you do that.
As your character is running in one direction in 3D space, and then that direction changes. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's just, no, not even close.
And that's something you can see to some degree in the design of games, that first-person shooters particularly have gotten a lot more contemplative since consoles took over, right? That in the heyday of PC first-person shooters, in the, like, Quake, Unreal, Half-Life 1, like, that era of things, stuff was a lot more fast-paced. Like, if you go back now and play, like, Quake Deathmatch or Quake 2, Quake 3 Deathmatch, they seem insanely fast compared to modern games, like just hyperkinetic. And, you know, you play a modern game, it's a lot more like move slowly and be tactical and take cover, you know, lots of cover shooters now. And I think control schemes probably, you know, one of the things feeding into that is that as the controls lose a little bit of that fast twitch edge that you get with mouse and keyboard, you have to think about the game design differently. In the case of shooters, what comes out of that is, all right, a little more slow and methodical and taking cover and, you know, clearing out an area and then advancing, as opposed to just running around like you're hopped up on some sort of stimulants all the time.
There's also genres of games that never made it across that divide. Like if you look at games like Civilization or something like a real-time strategy like StarCraft, there have been attempts. Like I think there was a StarCraft for Super Nintendo or Nintendo 64 or something like that. Like there's been some, or there's a SimCity for Super Nintendo, but they were never, not, it wasn't that they weren't the best platform to play the game on. They weren't even worth playing, even though I loved SimCity. Playing SimCity on the Super Nintendo always felt like just so slow, like playing the game through molasses, because it's just a clicking and scrolling game. So those genres that used to, you know, RTSs and simulation games dominated, not dominated, but they're very popular before consoles became the dominant way to play games. It's kind of sad. I like both those genres.
You can still get them on PCs. It's not like they've entirely gone away or anything.
But the thing is, though, that I would love Like, of course I can still, and I do still, although I'm often, I often avoid them because I like them too much and I get absorbed into them. But the...
You like your memories of them better than you like the actual playing of the
well,
game.
Well, that's probably true too. But the thing that I lament is that because the majority of money that's being spent building games and building really great, like, cinematic games of this style of... that Naughty Dog and some of these folks are doing on console, that's because that's where most of the games are being bought, that's where most of the money is getting spent. You can't have a $500 million game like Destiny in a genre that only works on PC, because just it would be insane. You'd never be able to make your money back. And so when you have that economic tendency, then you lose out on games that could have existed if everything was still on PC. So I think that's a great coverage of our topic. And thanks a lot for coming out, Phil, and being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it was great. We always want to know what our listeners think, so please give us some feedback, or, of course, subscribe to the show at www.upup.fm, or find us on iTunes, Up Up Down Down. See you next week. I won't ask you what games you've played, because you've already lamented that you don't get any chance to play.
Well, actually, the last game I played was Monument Valley. I really like that. So, I'm
Monument.
Yeah, on iPad.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, of course. That's yeah. It would be crazy to play Monument Valley on anything else.
Yeah, yeah, exactly.
No, I don't think it does. It even exist for anything else yet? Like, isn't
I don't
it?
Think so.
There's a rumor that it's coming to Xbox.
I thought it was coming. There was rumors it was coming on Android, but. Because it's no.
Oh yeah, I think they actually announced Android.
It seems like it'd be a weird one to do without a touch screen. Like I mean, you could do it with mouse and keyboard, no problem. But it seems weird to do like an Xbox Live or PSN version of it. I'm not entirely sure how that would work.
What I really like about the tablet version is that you actually hold the thing, right, and you're interacting with it as a. It becomes the object, much like a console, right? When you play, like, I watch my kids play with their 3DSs and stuff, or 2DSs, and they're holding the thing they're playing with, right? That's a very important factor in these games. So,
you know what? Now that I think about it, I think it might have been the Vita. Because okay. It has the touch.
Yeah, that would make more sense.
Yeah,
the touchscreen on the Vita hasn't got much of a workout, because so many games are more like versions of console games and stuff like that. So a lot of the touchscreen stuff tends to be really gimmicky. Like I don't know if we talked about this before, but I borrowed someone I know's Vita to play the Uncharted game that they did for the Vita, because I'm a big fan of that series. And all of the like touchscreen and the touch sense of air on the back stuff was all super gimmicky.
Like it's like the gimmicky 3D in some movies, basically.
Yeah, it was clearly just like, all right, you have to use every feature of this hardware, so figure out something that uses these crazy features that we've put on it. But I see, you know, now that the success of mobile and touchscreen games, you could see someone doing like a PSP game that was really focused on touch controls and it being pretty good, because you know, if you do a port of something like Monument Valley that's very touched focused, like I could definitely see that working.
Yeah, I'm not sure what the fidelity the quality of the touch controls are. I'm not sure how it competes with the touch on the iPad.
I don't know either. I've only played the one game.
Yeah, exactly. It's unclear to me. No, I'm much more of a casual gamer. Like all the games that I've mentioned and stuff, I like driving games or the things when I race, because I'm actually decent at those. But not racing on the iPad. I don't like the gimmicky part of turning the iPad to steer and stuff. That's kind of boring. But you know, racing, I like the Mario Kart stuff, especially the double dash one. When my kids were younger, they would just hang off at the back and be the punching person, and I would be the driver, and I would actually do pretty good. And my daughter is coming by and she's laughing at me like, Dad, come on. So.
You must like the new one, or have you had a chance to play the new Mario Kart?
There's a Wii that's coming, Wii U that's coming to this house soon, so we'll probably get the Mario Kart then. Because yeah, I've heard really good things about Mario Kart 8. But Double Dash was special in that you could play with a younger child, and it would feel like they'd be engaged because they'd be hanging off the back of your cart and punching people left and right and making them do things, and they could throw the shells and stuff and would concentrate on just the driving, which is the part I liked. So,
yeah, I totally missed that experience with Double Dash because we played a lot of Mario Kart 64 around the office. So we do multiplayer matches, and then we never really got into that with Double Dash. Like, we didn't have like a GameCube hooked up to the TV and the little lounge area outside our area. And my kids, my kids were definitely born before I switched from having the GameCube to having the Wii and the Xbox, but they weren't old enough to ever play Double Dash, in sort of its native form on the console. So I can see it being, so I basically only played like single player Double Dash, and now I'm playing a lot of Mario Kart Wii and Mario Kart 8 with the kids, but it's not the same thing. Like, you don't have that co-op aspect to it in quite the same way. The most you can co-op it, which we're talking about this a little bit in the after show last week as well, is because you can play through the GP stuff in multiplayer mode, you can do a race to try and unlock all the stuff together.
Yeah, right? Exactly.
Which gives you some co-op, but it's not the same as like two people driving on the same cart like you get with.
Which was the cool thing. The other one was it the Mario Land or something? Anyway, on the Wii, where when you die, you get into a bubble, and then you float around, and then the person who's not dead can pop your bubble, and you're back alive. So when you're playing with your kids, who are much better than you at this game, you can play along, and when you die, they're just going to rescue you, and you feel really good about it. So that's kind of cool, too. It's a cool game mechanic.
They did an interesting variant on that with the DLC add-on for New Super Mario Bros. U. New Super Mario Bros. U is like the same basic setup as New Super Mario Bros. Wii and like New Super Mario Bros. 1 and 2 on the DSs.
Right, which is the one with that bubble thing, right?
Yeah, they've all of those have got the bubble mechanic for multiplayer, and so does Super Mario 3D World, which is the like newest 3D Mario for the Wii U. But the interesting thing about New Super Luigi U, which is the DLC for New Super Mario Brothers.
Just let's pause and accept. Think about the name. Was it New Super Luigi Brothers U?
No, just New Super Luigi U. No.
Oh, okay.
Brothers,
okay. So it's not ridiculous.
It's getting pretty comical. They're gonna have to reboot and do New Super Mario Brothers.
Wasn't it the Year of Luigi last year? Nintendo?
This was one of the elements of the Year of Luigi. Anyways, that was a very long intro for. In New Super Luigi U, you've got like the three. So Mario's out. It's, he's off the table for this. You've got Luigi as the main guy, and you could be the two Toads. And then the fourth player is Nabbit, who's this guy who's like the villain, or not the villain, not like the big villain, but a villain in like the original game, New Super Mario Brothers U. But he basically is like invulnerable, not, like superstar invulnerable, like knocking guys off all the time, but he can't be injured by the enemies. And it's basically a way to like get little kids to play the game, is they can play as Nabbit and he just kind of runs along. It doesn't matter if he runs into the enemies, and he's got sort of a different mechanic where he's trying to collect power ups and then he gets extra lives at the end of the level for collecting the power ups. But it's basically exactly that. Like, it's a, it's a mode for the younger kids to get to play when they can't keep up.
The older adults.
Yeah. So it's kind of interesting.
Yeah, I definitely enjoy going way back to when Phil was saying he likes racing games. I definitely enjoy racing games, but there aren't any PS4 games out in the racing genre. I guess there's the Need for Speed one, which is a cross-platform, but it's nothing that's got my attention yet, so I'm looking forward to that. The Fuel, which is the, or not Fuel, Fuel was the previous game. The Crew is the one day we're talking about at E3, which I think it could be kind of interesting one on that genre.
I always get a racing game for every console I get, but I never actually play it much. Like, it's not something where I sit down and play through it. It's more like a keep it around, and when the mood strikes me toss off a couple of races. Yeah, you're going to do our semi-weekly check on VG charts, see how they're doing. The Nintendo has been burning up the charts the last little while.
I definitely expected that to be a one-week performance, but it looks like they've definitely been doing a lot better. Like the in the worldwide numbers, the Wii U is now way ahead of the Xbox One.
It's
good.
So week of the these are more than a week out of date. They haven't updated in a week.
Oh yeah, actually, this is the chart I have here on VG Charts is currently 2 weeks old as we're recording, which means it'll be 3 weeks old by the time this publishes. So yeah, by the time you are all listening to this at home, maybe Nintendo's gone bankrupt. but 3 weeks ago, they were doing great.
Nintendo is older than both Microsoft and Sony, so it's like, yeah, I think it'll stick around.
And technology, if age of the company, I hope you survive.
Well, they started as a playing card company, so it's all good.
Yeah, that's
they pivoted. They have successfully pivoted out of the playing card market and into video games. I think we can safely say that at this point.
Well, yeah, they're still in the playing card market because Pokemon's been going on forever.
Yeah, that card game lasted way longer than I expected to.
Yes.
Oh, so speaking of card games, so I've now got like two dozen matches worth of Hearthstone under my belt.
Oh yeah, so do you have a feel for it now?
Yeah, I'm definitely getting the hang of it. I think I'm only losing like 60 or 70% of my matches now, as opposed to like I lost all of the first five or six against real opponents. There's something wrong with that matchmaking. Like my first couple of matches, there was like one or two that I felt like, yeah, I probably could have won that if I'd been better. But there were also people that just had way better cards than I did.
Are you playing with the custom deck or the default one?
No, I was just playing with the default. I did like one of the ones with the custom deck and just got annihilated. And I mean, that makes sense. Like I still don't know if I understand enough about what mix you need to build a good deck, but even just playing with the default decks, like, you know, it'd be like my fireball does 4 points of damage and this guy's fireball does 8 points of damage. And it's like, all right,
well,
what am I supposed to do there?
Like that? No, that the cards are relatively well balanced. So first of all, you can only have two of each, but there is no card that's just a rare card that is clearly one like straight up better than another card. And so if their fireball deals way more damage, then it would probably be a fireball that costs way more mana or something like that. Like it's not just the same fireball, or maybe they have a bunch of plus spell damage out, so then it gives them a bonus when they cast that rather than just the card is better.
Is there a penalty when if you start a game and you bail out, do you like lose points or something like that? Or
well, I assume, so are you playing ranked games, Nigel, or are you doing
that? I'm just doing the casual ones still.
So I'm not convinced that the casual one has a good sense of whether or not you're winning or losing and, like, matchmaking properly. I'm not entirely sure. But on ranked, then, yeah, your rank will go down if you quit the game.
Right.
I'm not sure if you can, like, tank your rank intentionally on casual just by starting a bunch of games and quitting. Maybe you can and teach it that you suck.
It's got pretty flaky connectivity. Like it seems, I mean, I haven't had like a huge number of weird drops and stuff like that, but given how little of it I play, I feel like I shouldn't have had any. And I've had like, I think at least twice that it's just gone south, or like I think one of them was like, I accidentally hit the home button and then immediately went back in and it was like, nope, everything's gone.
Oh, definitely when you hit the home button and then come back, on my iPad, it pretty much is gone. But that's not connectivity. It's like it gets memory flushed or something.
Well, like, but it wasn't starting over from the beginning. Like it was clearly going back into the game. It's just having been backgrounded for like 5 seconds was enough to confuse it from a networking standpoint that it just spun for a little while and then gave me the you are disconnected thing. And one time it gave me that just in the middle of stuff as well.
Yeah, I don't think I've ever been disconnected just ongoingly playing the game, but definitely on the iPad, back routing is pretty flaky, but it's a 1.0.
Yeah.
You have much better stamina than I do, because when I started playing letterpress and started getting destroyed by all of these people that knew English much better than I did, I'm like, well, too bad, not playing this game anymore. It was about three games. Like, then I got letterpress because, hey, it's Lauren, it looks pretty cool, and he built his own UI kit and stuff. I'm like, okay, then I'm done, you know, with letterpress.
It's very hard for any game that's a competitive game like that to matchmake you appropriately when you have only played a few games. Yeah. Because if you just put anyone who's new against extreme people who suck a lot, then you make world even worse for people who suck a lot. Because some people who start will be have people who've already played before or who are naturally good at it. So you kind of have to treat a new account as kind of like an average player.
Yeah. Which may or may not be true, yeah. I think the only really good online multiplayer experience I've had was circling back Mario Kart on the Wii. It's like you can play with the world and you can match with people, and matchmaking is pretty good. And I felt like I could win some of these races, and you know, and I did.
Well,
win
you know
some
why that is though. It's not because the matchmaking is good. It's because Mario Kart is extremely heavily tuned to make it so that the match outcome is not just determined by how good you are.
Yeah, that's true. There's a lot of rubber banding in Mario Kart. Yeah.
And the shells that are just like, oh, you're in last place? Here's a thing that makes you kill the guy who's in first place.
Yes, or get a chain that makes you go faster. Exactly, yeah.
Exactly.
But then again, even given all of those, I won my fair share of matches, I thought. So it was kind of fun, you know. It wasn't realistic by any means, but it was fun.
Maybe that's what they need, is some more rubber banding in Hearthstone.